Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. March 8th, 2015, episode number 74, can only make me stronger. March has not come in like a lion. In fact, it's down for the count and trying to figure out what the heck happened. Hi everyone, this is Kevin England, and I am back to regular form after having been sick with a cold for about a month and a half. While I'm still, can you believe it, still not 100%, I am mostly functional, and my cough and rundown state has actually abated. The formidable pile of things that I had to do and that I want to do sits all around me, but that does not kill me can only make me stronger. I guess that's a little bit morbid, but I do have some sense that I've emerged from the plague, so you'll have to forgive the dark undertone of the opening. Maybe I should sing some James Brown. I feel good, na-na-na-na-na-na, like I knew that I would. So good, so good. I got you, ow. Whoa. That might have been the most, you know, Kevin moment for the record books, but I digress. I've been listening to James Brown. He's awesome. I went back and listened to his stuff from the 60s and into the 70s. I know his rap, don't get me wrong. I know the backstory, but just the music. Yep, lots to talk about. What to say? Let me see now. What do we have on the pile for today? Have you heard about the new sensation that's rocking the nation? Yes, my friends, it's the Flow Hive. It slices, it dices, and it makes fresh bread. Well, not really. It'll give you honey for your bread, so we'll go with that. B, strike team specialist reporting for duty. Some thoughts about being prepared for the bee spill planned. A follow-up to 74, that is episode 74, Mead Part 2 and some extras on the topic. June tea introduction, a wear a hive future, a point of view editorial from me. Listener shout-outs, and maybe a few other things to throw in along the way. But if you're a regular listener, you know the drill. What comes next? The Local Hive Report. The weather reference, March comes in like a lion and goes out like a lamb, has proved flawed so far for 2015. While it's only the first week, we still don't have any sense of warm over 45 degrees Fahrenheit on the radar. 45, 55, that's generally the time when you start to see bees fly, so that's really what we're concentrating on. We might have an occasional teaser here and there, but I'm starting to see the wisdom of John Gott's Way, a reference for those new to the podcast to the insulation feature we did back in episode number 72, where he was protecting his hives from the cold. I'm resigned to the fact that our hives are in trouble in our yard. I've heard from other beekeepers about the wonder of hive excrement, meaning cleansing flights that colored the snow recently, but my yard does not have that welcome yellow hue in the snow. There's spots here and there and a couple bees that have been carried out, but nothing to write home about where you would see big, strong hives, and I'm rather concerned. I'm of the belief that three or maybe even four of my remaining hives are gone, and I'm not sure about the longevity of those remaining. I have to say I'm dejected and impatient for spring to get here so I could pull up my sleeves and go forward with whatever makes it through. I'm not going to talk about hives directly, but more about my breakthrough and my breaking point of realization that I need a change. It's been known to me for a while that my property is just not conducive to keeping bees. A recent conversation or consultation, as it might be, with our state apiarist has convinced me that I need a new plan. It's that moment where you look and say, that's when I've made my decision. I was chatting with Tim the other day and he casually said to me that he didn't like my property for bees. I know that he stopped by one morning to drop something off for me, and my envision is that he got a first-hand look at my bee yard, and what I suspect is that he saw the condition that has plagued this spot from the beginning, which is no morning sun. Our bees just don't get that morning alarm clock because the sun doesn't cross over the trees from the wooded lot nearby until about 10 a.m. on a good day. In plant parlance, the good stuff is already gone for the day and our bees are late to the party. So there I've said it. My yard sucks for bees. It's not something that's funny and laughable, but I feel like Alcoholics Anonymous, where I finally admitted something. I've said it out loud. I've been trying to avoid this forever, and I've known it all along. And still, there's something about being able to walk outside and be amongst the bees on your property. To not have to get into your vehicle and go to a destination, which is what I'm facing. It's not how I envisioned beekeeping, and it's going to take some of the magic out of it for me. But I'm resigned to the fact I have come to the decision that I need to make a change. I don't think I'll give up bees totally on my property, but I will keep the larger subset somewhere else that has viable forage, good protection, and more importantly, morning and full-time sun. In a true, if you know me, Kevin fashion, I want to see this as a glass half-full activity. I've had some requirements for beekeeping that I've always wanted to meet, and this will give me the opportunity to have adequate access with a vehicle, something that I can't do today. Typically, the best I could do when the ground is not soft is get in there with a tractor and a trailer pulled behind it, but it's not ideal. In fact, I want to negotiate the ability to invite our association members to whatever the site is going to be for a hands-on day and teach them about a top bar hive, a polystyrene hive, a ware hive, all medium hives, 8-frame hives, and so on. It's always been my envision while I dabble in these different form factors to be able to invite others to experience the wealth of this. Now, I've been hinting at an outyard for 2 seasons, but internally, I knew I was probably considering a primary yard somewhere else and not an outyard. Part of it was trying to clear this with the boss, who seems to understand the dilemma, having seen me struggle with pain and realizing that the bees are in trouble. And whatever I keep in my home will be recreational, and I'll make sure I supplement it with the primary hives to ensure it survives with strong resources coming back and something that can overwinter no matter what. So, truth be told, when you look at a hive develop, after a number of seasons, you could tell if it's strong, if it has gusto, and it's a good hive. I don't think my bees are bad. I don't think that they have the want, and if in the right situation, wouldn't be gangbusters. And while my hive seemed adequate in the fall last year, I know that I let my optimism get the best of me because I was trying to make lemonade out of lemons here, and that they were not really the strongest hives. They had a reasonable amount of weight. They had a reasonable amount of bees. But, you know, Bob Kloss came over in the fall, and he was kind when he said that he thought they were okay. We talked about that recently. But I just know from my own body language that we were trying to make something nice out of it. I won't put words in your mouth, Bob, but even I could recognize that there was a reasonable amount of risk if we had a harsh winter, and boy, did we have a harsh winter. It's like cruel fate, I think. And while we have not had a Boston winter, locally it has to be said that it has been brutally cold this year. I don't think I need to talk about it, as the whole United States has seen its share of winter, so no whining. I'm going to postulate 2 things, incidentally, about this winter. A lot of hives died. I can only imagine that I'm not alone. And number two is because of the harsh winter, spring is going to absolutely explode. And let me explain why I think that. It's been my experience that plants go dormant and bugs die when the winters are harsh. Because not as many bugs are going to emerge and eat all the plants and do all that, it has to help in plant development. If there were going to be three plants eaten by bugs, there will only be one, and those other two will create abundance in forage. And plants that have hunkered down in the wintertime tend, in my estimation, to explode when growing degree days tell them that it's their turn to go. Time will tell if I'm right about these things, and I'll be interested to watch another season come and go and see what my wisdom tells me. 1, 2, 3, 4 hives. If they make it through the winter, I don't know. It might be 45 degrees this weekend, and it'll give me a chance to check our hives and see if some fondant might help. This is a really sucky time to lose a hive when spring is so close you could taste it. I think no matter what goes on, I'm going in this weekend. I have not been around the last 3 weekends. My hives seem to have consumed their stores and appear light to me. I want to make sure, if possible, that I don't let them starve when they are on the home stretch. Cold or not, if they're in trouble, I'm opening them up this weekend. For those who are doing well, let me add what I hoped to be doing this time of year, so maybe you can live vicariously through that notion. Normally, I would think March 15th is the time for first actions for a strong workforce. When March comes in like a lion, as it's supposed to, bees are getting prepped for the nectar flow, and the queen, if she has adequate food and proteins, starts her quest for spring domination. Now this year, maybe not so much. My guess is the cold has likely retarded that start for all of the hives, and I suspect that the colonies will get a late start and lag in colony growth. Now, if you're in a hive that is insulated or just has a banging number of bees, they don't care, because they have a big enough cluster that the colony can get to work inside. But I'm guessing a lot of hives took a whooping this winter, so we'll see. So here's hoping for all of you that it doesn't go from, man, it's cold, to, this is just ridiculous. We had no spring and now it's friggin' summer. I guess either way, you have to take solace in this. The forsythia is going to bloom and the dandelions will pock our yards and beekeepers will be happy for soft spring breezes that will cure all of our winter doldrums. I'll keep everyone posted on my scouting of a new bee yard for 2015. So that brings to close a less than stellar local hive report. Before I get into segment one, let me share some contact and website information. You could reach me at kevin@bkcorner.org. Comments, suggestions for topics, insights on your thoughts on what we present are all welcome. Please, if you write in, let us know where you are writing from and how to pronounce your name. Our website, still unfortunately the old format, but I still aspire to resolve at some point. What do I mean by that? If you're new, I built a completely new website and I'm almost ready to flip the switch. I have some technical things to take care of, but because I've been ill, I haven't been able to get to it. So still on the to-do list. But the address for the old one, which is still being maintained, is www.bkcorner.org. I've been posting odds and ends at our Facebook page between episodes. And some of our listeners have been sharing things too, which I've been trying to promote. Facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. I have to say, I have the best listeners anywhere and everywhere. People sharing things with us, sharing their thoughts. a real good dialogue, and I do appreciate everybody who takes the time. Last but not least, some new videos have been loaded on the Northwest YouTube channel for you to check out. The web address for that is youtube.com/NWNJBA. Somewhere along the line, I didn't have this planned, but I'm going to throw in a preview of what's new out there because there's some interesting things that should be called out. Okay, that's it. Let's go to segment number one. Segment number one is about a polyester casting resin project that I did a while back. I want to say it was September, October of last year. I've always had this interesting notion to take some bees and put them in a resin type thing where you can be, you know what I'm talking about, those hard, clear shapes that have some sort of thing embedded in them. I always wanted to know how to do that. So one afternoon, I made a trip to Michael's, which is a craft store, and I picked up a two-part catalyzer, a clear polyester casting resin, and used, you know, the hardest part about this, and let me talk about the process, is there are many different ways to do this, and you could look online or you can go to a store. For me, I wanted to go to a store and buy the products right size. Sometimes when you get these things, they're in huge vats, and I really didn't want that amount. I wanted a small amount just so I could experiment. And I know that it's a two-part piece where you pour the resin in and you pour some sort of catalyst and you stir the two together. You pour a little bit into a mold. You put whatever it is that you're going to embed in the resin, and then you pour the rest over and you let it harden. So it did exactly that. I followed the instructions on the packaging for this. I could say that the store experience was rather interesting. It took us forever to find this in the store. And then when we found it, they had one brand which I had done some research on and I was interested in, but they didn't have catalyst for it. So I guess one of the stories I'll tell you is you might be better off if you know what you want to order it online. Or maybe that's just a singular Michael's experience. I don't know. Generally, have really good luck at looking at Michael's for these type of things. But this is probably so unique that they don't carry it. People didn't know how to do it and so on. I knew more about it and was looking it up on my phone in the store versus the sales clerk who just wasn't, frankly, very helpful in it. So the bigger part of the experience was actually trying to find some sort of container to get the right shape and size. And also, you're supposed to buy some sort of wax something container that helps to release the resin. If you've ever worked with these resins, once they get in the mold, you don't get them out unless you have a special kind of mold. So I had envisioned using some sort of wax-based or silicone mold, but could not find anything. At the end of the day, I went to a jewelry area and picked out these little molds that made what's the equivalent of a small ice cube. That's the best way to describe it. I took my chances with this. I mixed the resin. I took some bees that I collected that had been deceased recently. They were, you know, out in the yard. So I didn't kill any bees for this. And I put them in there. And I created these resins and let them sit. So you have to let this stuff cure, and it takes forever. What I had done, the reason I forgot about doing this back in September timeframe, was I had poured these resins and waited about a month, maybe a little bit longer, and I went after the first one. And the plastic tray that I used that was like a mini ice cube thing, I was able to pull the plastic back and pop the thing out. It wasn't easy, but I was able to actually peel it back. What I found out is that even after a month, these resin pills, so to speak, ice cubes, were not hardened. And the first one that I took out, I left fingerprints on and smudged them up a little bit. So I took the remaining ones, and I had made one test case, so that was the one I popped out. And it really took a significant effort to get the plastic out around it, because the resin was still a little bit soft. So I put it back on the shelf and I just left it there. I think I waited till about January time frame. Got a little frog in my throat here, sorry. And pulled the thing apart and then stripped the plastic off on the remaining ones. They were much, much harder. Firm, no fingerprints. And what had happened the first time is when the plastic twisted and pulled against, it left like shades or imprints on the resin. In this case, they're hard, like solid ice cubes, and had no difficulties with that. So actually, for a first effort, they turned out pretty good. I made three little cubes for my first experiment, and I'm holding them there, holding them in my hand. And they look good. They're clear. They're smooth. They're neat. When I showed them to people, they thought they were really cool. I could give this one disappointment about this that bothered me. And I don't know how to solve this problem. There must be a way, and maybe somebody knows the answer to this. When you get a bee that is wet, it looks like it shrinks up and it does not look like a normal bee as you would expect it. I would have thought that taking bees that had freshly deceased, they were still in what looked like they were alive, but they weren't moving, and putting them in this resin that they would maintain that state because it's like a plastic. But the fact of the matter is the resin made them kind of wet looking and they shrunk and they don't look as appealing. I wanted a full-blown, you know, thick Jurassic Park kind of encapsulation with this, and that's not the result. So one of the things I'm going to look into, and I still have enough polyester resin to make about 1,000 of these things, even with the small capacity that I bought, is finding a way to preserve the bee so that when I pour it in the mold, it will maintain its almost alive bee-looking appearance. It's a neat project, and it's really one of those things that I think anybody can do. One of the things I will caution you is this stuff smells really bad. It just has that really chemical, resiny, polyester, gross smell to it if you've ever worked with it. So do it outside or with the windows open, and make sure that once you pour it, you put it somewhere where it's not going to gas out, that you have to smell it all the time. And even after a month when I decoupled that first one, it still had a strong odor as it was curing. So you really want to let this thing sit for at least 2 to 3 months before you start messing around with it. Objective number two for me is to find the right molds. That plastic thing worked. At the end of the day, it worked, but it was not ideal. And they make molds specifically for this. And I just didn't want to take the time to do the research for it, but next time I go in, I will do it. Do I really need these things? No. I just wanted to try it, and I thought they were really cool. And now when people come over every once in a while, I go, hey, look at this thing. Isn't this cool? And they are fascinated for 30 seconds, and I've achieved my claim to fame on this of what I wanted to do, right? Just a little neat little project that you could do. I did it over the winter time when we were not taking care of bees, and I think it turned out really good, so give it a try. It's Castin, Castin Craft is the name of the brand of resin that I used. There's a bunch of different ones out there, but this one worked really well for me, and I would recommend it. Other than that, I don't know what else to tell you to look for. You could do the research. If you have any experience in these things and you want to send a note where we can inform the listeners better ways to go about this, please feel free to write in kevin@bkcorner.org. And somewhere along the line, I guess I'll try and take a picture of these and post them up in my spare time. But I'll do my best. Okay. That's it for segment number one. Let's check out segment number two. Segment number two is called Imperative. This is about the flow hive, and it's imperative that we talk about this. There was a palpable buzz when we talked about the flow hive in our last episode. And as a beekeeper or soon-to-be beekeeper or somebody just stumbled upon us, you have to have heard about this thing. The presentation videos had done their job, but I don't think anyone could have predicted the overnight phenomena that was to come in the days since we shared the insights about this on our last episode. I have received dozens upon dozens of emails, Facebook shares, and even personal interactions with everyday Joes who stop me on the street and say, "Are you a beekeeper? Have you heard about this thing?" It's crazy. Crazy how much publicity this thing has. To footnote this, my boss sent me an email asking me if I had seen this thing. I mean, just everybody knows about it. Phenomena is what this is, pure and simple. Yet, the unkind and ungentle side of my personality starts to emerge, and I've been asked point blank by some listeners to weigh in on this thing. I find human nature very interesting. Some people are absolutely enthralled and can't wait to get the opportunity to have the experience with this thing. And the other ones have been like trolls, just ridiculously attacking every facet of it in a righteous kind of crusade manner. I will say that from the action of beekeepers in the public at large, it's so typical of our age. Some laud this thing as the next coming, such a wonderful device. And others only loathe it and are mounting a campaign with every moral fiber of their being to detract the concept and tear it down. I hate this about society. I hate it. Still, one has to be oneself, and in a Kevin moment, I am a kind and gentle soul and teach my kids that taking the high road is the right answer on so many occasions. I instruct them to be transparent about their communications, especially when their welfare and personal relationships are in the mix, and not to live a lie when it matters. That's an end of a Kevin moment. I'm in a position with power from this production of this podcast to weigh in a Wizard of Oz kind of way. What does Kevin think about this? Should I invest? Is this a bad idea for reason X, Y, and Z? Won't you say it on your podcast? Because people need to see the light. Wow, hold on a minute. I have my way of communication. I'm a glass half full kind of guy and applaud ingenuity and can forgive what I perceive as misguided folly. So case in point, I recently saw what I'll sum up as a scam operation about getting started in beekeeping. Terrible delivery, wrong information, and certainly peril to the unsuspecting people who get snared by this advertisement that's been out there. Even as such, I don't feel it's my crusade to go on a witch hunt to shut it down. If someone asks me directly, and you want to know, you can write in, I will emphatically tell them, don't do this. Stay away from it. But for the most part, I am just not going to go out of the way. The person's got a livelihood, and there's some good in there with some of the bad. And at the end of the day, all beekeepers need a place to start. And hopefully you'll seek several sources, not only this one, to find your way in this world and be able to tell when things are not in the right place. So, okay, I've been dodging this. The flow hive. What do I really think? It's time for me to be transparent and share my impressions. I have to say, like everyone else, I was captivated by the messaging. The videos were cool. The premise is based on a new hive design, which you, if you know me, absolutely gets my juices flowing, and I'm immediately drawn to that. But the videos and the marketing had a bit of infomercial kind of feel to it that created a little cognitive dissonance with me. Something just didn't sit right. I'll get this out of the way. I don't think it's a good idea, but I don't think that anyone can make a proper assessment without practical experience. So there's no right answer. That is the answer. There's no right answer right now. These people need the benefit of the doubt, and they need our support to deliver whatever it is. And if history judges them that they should not have gone this path, the consumer will speak. Yeah, you say, well, Kevin, you must have other ideas. I mean, really, what do you think? If you can't tell by now, I probably would be good on a debate team. I could talk about the pros and cons of each side of the argument and sound pretty convincing. For the fear of looking back and cringing someday about what I say about this episode, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I think it's safe to step through some initial impressions without passing judgment. So in no particular order, here's what I really think. The marketing was spectacular. First rate and magical. The video messaging, right down to the person trickling honey on pancakes, was just brilliant. Anytime you see that, you have to immediately take pause. But on a marketing message, they hit a home run. Number two, while I love gadgets, it remains to be seen if this is a good Hive system. And only practical experience will be able to tell. I could look at it right now and have my thoughts, but at this point, you can't tell until you actually use it. Given some of the recommendations that they've had thus far, Michael Bush being one prominent name I'm familiar with, an endorsement, if that's what really happened, I have to envision that this thing is not as bad as some of the fearmongers are making out there about this being terrible, terrible, terrible idea. You have to keep in perspective, number three, that people probably scoffed at Langstroth's idea, so it deserves a look-see. But to me, it smells a little bit like industrialized farming. Does it make sense to put a plastic contraption in a hive? Food-grade plastic notwithstanding. You know, heck, I don't even like the idea of plastic foundation. I've purged it all from my hives. So my initial impression on the substrate is thumbs down. Don't like it. I noticed the messaging was changed since the days of launch, but there was one blemish on the way that they approach us. The proprietors have responded to some criticism by calling out that bee management is required. From the impression of the emails and public reaction, it seemed to me that the public assumed that you put this thing out in the backyard and voila, you would be able to get some honey at the turn of a spigot. Now, we as beekeepers all know that's a silly notion, but there didn't seem to be any sense in the messaging that one actually has to manage bees. So that's a knock on the delivery. And I have to say this in their defense. I understood their messaging that said less intrusion, but I don't think they intended to lead anybody down the path that you didn't have to manage the bees. Yet, if you give this to someone like the mainstream press, they're going to kind of gloss over the details of that and, by all accounts, conveniently leave that stuff out. And in credit to the two proprietors, it looks like they have been trying to make sure that message is not lost in their recent communications. Whether anybody will actually report that or not, I'm not sure. So number five, I think I'm under number five. I am. These guys are beekeepers. They have to know that the world would judge them, and as they tinkered and toil over the last 10 years, can we imagine that they had nothing but the best interest of our bees in their design? At the core of core, simplest being the explanation, that has to be true. And it's my greatest hope that the compass of these gentlemen was pointing in the right direction. And when I see it for real, I'm going to know that they were sincere in their quest to improve how we do beekeeping. I can't imagine how they could have fathomed $3 million plus interest, meaning they made more than $300 million or $3 million on their startup. But at the core, almost every beekeeper loves their bees, so I cannot believe that they were in this for the money. They just weren't. And last but not least, for a few days afterwards, I tried to study the videos to see how things worked. It's my curiosity. My strong initial impression was that this thing looks rather intrusive. And haven't we been talking about less interference lately? What about the hive ecosystem? How does this thing work in there? I mean, it's bad enough the Langstroth hive is a poor facsimile created by man for the industrialized beekeeping area, but this is going in the wrong direction. We should be emulating trees, not plastic condos. That's pretty harsh, sorry, but it's just my final impression on that. And maybe when I see it for real, I'll change my mind or whatever, but I suppose I could go on, but time will pass and we'll become a little bit wiser with practical experience. I will end on this note, which echoes my commentary from our intro in the last episode. Good for these guys. Really, I wish them great success and wisdom to carry through on, make no mistake, the burden that has been bestowed upon them to have to deliver $3 million worth of product. Two guys, $3 million worth of product. Think about how insurmountable that is for a major company, let alone these two guys who never anticipated their life to take that direction. They have an unexpected amount of product to deliver, a tall order indeed, and I still root for them, and there's nothing that should be rewarded more than the entrepreneurial spirit. I believe that with all the fabric of my being. So that being said, it's not a nice way to do this. As for me, I'm not going to order one. I'll be interested to see in someone else's results with it, and if it turns out I am wrong, that it's more than a gadget or a unitasker, I'll consider one. You know, I liken it to this Apple phone, iPhone phenomena in the United States. I'm a bit jaded because I do mobile technologies for a living. Apple is by far the dominant platform in the U.S., and it's predicted to make Apple $1.3 trillion company, if you believe the forecasts. I don't like their model. I don't like their product. I don't like the way they charge an Apple tax on everything. I can't believe anybody has any love for iTunes. And I can't understand why anyone would use it. So, no, Apple doesn't have any of my money in their current tally. At some point when Apple becomes Skynet and we have no choice to be assimilated, I guess I will go down kicking. I'll be the guy trying to work with the Terminator to put an end to it. As far as the Flow Hive goes, I will wait and watch with anticipation, and I will be a late adopter if that is the destiny before me. And that might sum up, best of all, my first impressions. Feel free to go over to our Facebook page and share some of your commentary, but please be nice. I've seen some people write some really terrible things about this, and I don't understand why people feel like they have to be that way. So there's a post up there about it on our Facebook page. If you want to share your commentary, we would welcome your thoughts and insights, your observations. Most of what I've seen over the last couple of weeks has been really interesting in people's thoughtful responses about this hive and its place in the future. So happy to hear from you about that. Segment number 3. Bee Spill Strike Team Specialist reporting for duty. I can't help but be in that frame of mind. I'm currently reading the book I, Sniper. Well, actually, I'm listening to it through an audiobook. What a spectacular book so far. Highly recommended. Nope, I'm not sponsored by Audible.com. State apiarist Tim Schuler recently sent out a reminder about confirming New Jersey's state bee spill plan for incidents that could occur in the Garden State. I have volunteered, if they'll have me, to be a part of that strike team. I have to think that as each year passes, our chances for a large-scale incident increases, given the odds. New Jersey is a main thoroughfare for bees passing through to go to apples, blueberries, cranberries up north, and we are one of the largest blueberry producers in the world here in New Jersey proper. I started to think about a better game plan to be prepared. I put some incidentals in my truck last year following what Tim had shared, but as I think about it, it's probably not really a good effort on my part. Consider a situation where a semi-load of bees is involved. I've kind of been asking around what that experience might be like, so I'm mentally prepared for that type of thing. Account after account of what I hear is that bees are not really pleased about the situation. The likelihood of a good number of stings is real to anybody participating, and you should have a good plan, a good game plan for a protective envelope. Having been a firefighter in the past, I understand that notion wholeheartedly. And to that end, there are a number of other practical things that should be in a preparation kit, and I thought I'd share what I have in mind to keep, to compare notes, so to speak, if you do this type of thing. So, an obvious statement is a bee suit is a requirement, a hive tool, a smoker, beekeeping gloves, and they've asked us to bring some fuel and some drinks. But what about other things to consider? So the suggestion was to keep a case of water or half a case of water in your vehicle, but I'm thinking electrolytes are really important. I know from firefighting days, a summer day in head-to-toe protection requires a lot of fluids and something to eat. Now, granted, somebody might bring you something, but if you're out on 95 somewhere in the middle of nowhere and you're in amongst the bees, chances are you're a long way off from a drink and a meal. Flashlight, preferably with a red lens. Bees can't see red, and if the incident takes place at night, a white light at night is a sting here beacon. Another consideration is spare clothes. I think this is especially appropriate for me if I'm at work, which I am most days, and we get called out, and I have to go from there. My office uses business casual attire, which means dress slacks, a button-up shirt, dress shoes. I don't think I'm going to be out doing a bee-cell situation with that under my bee suit. So I'm going to certainly need to have something at my disposal to change into. And I'm not intending to go home first, so I'll have to make provisions for extra clothes in my vehicle. Both clothes to wear under the protective envelope and as a bonus, I think I'm going to want something to change into for the ride home after the incident. Another item to throw in, it should just be in your vehicle at any given time, is some duct tape. It makes sense for any emergency kit and certainly could come to use here for taping up hives or holes or things like that. I've been considering a jumpsuit for extra protection over pants. And another layer that a stinger can't get through and something to protect my clothing. You're working on a tractor trailer rig, it might be an accident scene. If you've ever been involved in that, typically, unless you're wearing bunker gear for firefighting and protective clothes, regular street clothes get ruined. It's almost a foregone conclusion. To that end, I'm thinking something like a can of rubbing alcohol would come in handy for cleaning things, or maybe, as a fallback, some hand wipes in a pinch. I am envisioning a hive broken apart with honey all over the place and everything being sticky and, yeah. It stands to reason that a simple toolkit with a screwdriver, hammer, basic wrenches might come in handy. Again, this is an accident scene, and having some fundamental tools is something that time and time again from my rescue and firework has come in handy. Simply, sometimes you just need a flat-headed screwdriver to pry something. I'm thinking every beekeeper should have nitrile gloves, and it would make sense to that end to have a second pair of regular gloves, because again, I think what you're wearing is probably going to get honey soaked at some point, and a change of gloves is probably likely if you're at a longer operation. And at minimum, non-beekeeping related, it just seems to make sense that you might have a notebook, some pens, papers, maybe, dare I say, a name tag or something like that. So these things constitute the basics, and I suppose I was just riffing, but there's certainly more things I could add if I think about it a little bit further. I could think of some esoteric things that might come in handy for the perfect situation where you could just walk around the house and collect what you want before you go and you have time. So, for example, I might consider some two-way radios to have at your disposal. Someone walks away from the truck or whatever, and you need to have them come back or give commands or whatever, you could do that. I have an old-fashioned megaphone that we always joke around with at parties when somebody's outside, take it out and go, step away from the... Yeah. I could certainly think we could find a use for that on a scene. I'm the opinion that you should never go anywhere without a video camera or some sort of regular camera. But actually, that notion has been quelled by the fact that my cell phone is so good at both of those things anymore that I don't need to carry those things unless I'm shooting actual features. But who wants to muck up their cell phone? And to that end, I guess I don't want to wreck my expensive VCR video camera thing. I mentioned it before, but some sort of name tags. I can envision us all looking like spacemen walking around and nobody knows who's who. So name tags, temporary ones that you could write on with a Sharpie, seem to make a lot of sense. It's not like firefighting equipment where, you know, you have your name sewn on the back of your equipment so when you're going in you could tell who is in front of you. And a lot of firefighters take their name and put them in stencils across the front of their shield. So when you're looking at somebody, you could tell who they are. We don't have any such ideas in beekeeping for this type of thing. And I guess last but not least, and this would be a luxury because I don't own one, is a full head-to-toe bee suit. One of the mesh kinds that let you breathe but really prevent you from getting stung. That would be the bomb for this type of thing. And maybe somewhere down the road. But for this, I don't know. You know what? If you go to one of these incidents and you had one, you would thank your lucky stars afterwards because you'd be the smartest guy on the scene. So what would you bring? Anything I missed? Write me in because I'm going to put together a duffel bag this spring because bee season is coming and it won't be long before these trucks are traveling through the highways nearby, and I want to make sure that I'm prepared for this. I'm going to stash a bag in the lower compartment in my truck, and I'm looking for ideas if you have any that I've missed. Kevin@bkcorner.org. Segment number four I call NJBA Recap. For segment number four, I wanted to do a recap on the 2015 New Jersey Beekeepers Association winter meeting. The meeting included a guest speaker, Tony Jadzak, who is the Maine State apiarist and bee inspector, along with NJBA's Joe Alvarez, talking about the state's crop grant program. I also had a half-hour slot to cover two topics, and state apiarist Tim Schuler rounded out the talk with his annual New Jersey State of the Union apiarist report. Tony's a former New Jerseyan who has transplanted to Maine many years back. He does have his roots here in the Jake Mathenius days and started out with the Rutgers beginner course like so many beekeepers in New Jersey. He talked about his start in New Jersey and then moved on to things going on in Maine and his tenure as the apiarist there. Some of the highlights that he covered piqued my interest. The government is considering changing the way some products are applied, and it impacts the availability of said products to beekeepers. The U.S. is going to an approach that emulates what the EU has done in this space. Restrictions are coming for over-the-counter biotics used in animal reproduction. Included in this list of affected application are some chemicals that beekeepers use, including terramycin, Thailand, lincomycin. But oddly, fumagillin is not involved in that, which is something that is used in animal husbandry. This is supposed to go into effect in 2016, and in case it's not clear, bees are mixed in with animals in the way that the government sees it, so this does impact beekeepers. To my mind, I know people use terramycin for various ailments, and not having access to it would probably be detrimental. I'm not inclined to say I've ever used it before. More information about this can be found in a veterinary feed directive. He cited Volume 78, Number 239 of the Federal Register. He warned that it was not palatable reading. It's typical government stuff, but in the nuggets of wisdom somewhere in there, you can find out the details of what I've just mentioned. Another topic Tony spoke of has to do with interactions with fungicides, something that was reported by Marianne Fraser from Penn State. He indicated they are finding high levels of a product called Bravo, which is a synergist with fluvalinate. It makes fluvalinate and even check mite strips more impactful. Most people are not using Cumafos and fluvalinate anymore, but you do find it sometimes in the wax that is sold in foundation. In contrast, he said Ametraz, which is not legal in the United States for bees, but a lot of commercial beekeepers are using it, and it's something you get out of the animal world. It goes through a different pathway for detoxification for the bees and has thus far dodged the problems of synergism. But as a product, Ametraz is starting to demonstrate resistance. He indicated that Ametraz is a much higher concentration than the commercial version of Apilof Var. If I have the right product, I always get all these Apilofs wrong. Apilof Var, I'm pretty sure, is the right one, which is the commercial version for us, and it's at a lower dosage. He said that the dosage that they used to use for the products was a higher percentage, and the product that they gave to us commercially is a fairly low percentage, and he thinks the reason for that is as mites may develop resistance to this, they can up the dose a little bit and keep the product on the market longer. To me, I'm just happy to have the least amount of potency needed to kill bees, if that's what we're doing, and not nuke them, so to speak. Of course, ideally, we would avoid it altogether, but eventually, we'll probably up the dose enough to make either super mites, which are very bad, or just becomes ineffective, and this is probably a dead end in the end. One interesting call-out about his experience is that he's not seen any bee kills by use of neonicotinoids. He commented that farmers are rotating crops on fields that have plants with neonicotinoids, and the subsequent plants, which could potentially pick up the residues, do not apparently cause problem for the bees. I would tell you there were more nuggets in there to pick out, but I want to move on in this episode. So consider taking a look at our YouTube channel. We'll have his talk posted out there in the coming days. I mentioned Joe Alvarez spoke. He talked about the NJBA crop grant, which is winding down at least the activities for 2014. He recapped the program, which was very successful in my eyes, and talked about what he has on tap for 2015. The committee is working collaboratively with the Jersey Central Power and Light Company to plant under some of the utility right-of-ways there. They're doing a trial with them. And I think that's just a great step forward for beekeepers to try and see if we can get additional forage in the state of New Jersey. That video of Joe's talk is out on the YouTube channel, and so is Tim Schuller's state apiarist report for 2014. Tim talked about the winter death loss numbers coming in this year and also about other initiatives he has going on. That one specifically, I will tell you to go out and watch to get the stats directly from him. I mentioned I did speak at the meeting, too. I did some coverage on the final numbers for the New Jersey Swarm Report and previewed some of the insights about the aforementioned YouTube channel that gets plugged here often. A lot of people are not familiar with it, and I saw our usership, the number of people looking at videos, over the coming days after that meeting spike a little bit, as I guess people didn't know it was out there. YouTube.com/NWNJBA is the address for that. The final stats and summary of the Swarm Report, which we talked about, are available at the New Jersey Swarm website, www.njswarm.com. www.bees.com. So that wraps it up for our segments of this episode. Time to get to the back of the book. We'll talk about our roundtables. These are just general topics in no particular order. Follow-ups, listener mail, things like that. So let's go ahead and get started with roundtable number one. So I'm going to start with a somber note, one that I don't particularly want to talk about, but I guess I'll get out of the way. Roundtable number one is called Sad News. I was shocked to hear the passing of Dr. Peter Thiel. I saw the news in the UC Davis newsletter this week, and my heart goes out to the family and his coworkers and friends and anybody that knew him. You may recall us talking about his efforts in the segment A Line in the Pan from the episode This is Cool. Dr. Thiel was a research leader in the USDA lab in Gainesville, Florida, and in my mind was doing some groundbreaking work on problems plaguing the bees. 2 years ago, when we were in Florida, I tried to work into the trip itinerary a possibility of dropping in and getting a tour at Gainesville. And really what I was after is look to see if I could find him and interview or talk to him to follow up on the research he was working on. Unfortunately, a significant storm hit on the only day that was available in the itinerary, and we ended up scrapping our plans. Truth be told, I'm planning on going to Florida in the first quarter here and harbored the notion of seeing that I could possibly fit this in the itinerary again. Maybe we were going to be able to swing by Gainesville as we were moving around the state. I have a couple things planned. And, you know, not to say that this shouldn't still be a notion, but I'm less compelled because he was actually the person I wanted to talk to in person. And I am really deeply saddened by his loss, by the loss. I'm sure that Gainesville will continue their efforts, and it is a significant loss and a sad day for beekeepers. I think in remembrance, tomorrow on my way to work, I'm going to go back and preview some of the videos I shot of him talking at the ABF conference that I got and listen to that episode once more. Godspeed, Dr. Thiel. You will be missed. Roundtable number two, we call this one Mead Part 2. In the last episode, I spoke of making mead, which for those of you who don't know what that is, it's commonly referred to as a honey wine, but it's actually not a wine. You mix honey and water, and with either the natural yeast or yeast that you introduce, it ferments the honey and turns into an alcohol drink. So I thought I'd give an update to the progress of what we were working on. When we last left you. That sounds like a reference to the days of our lives, some sort of soap opera. When we last left you, I had shared that we split the mead in half. The whole batch that we made was in a gallon jug, put half of it in the refrigerator, and left half of it out to see if it would ferment further and become more alcohol-like. And it did just that. Actually, I was concerned that the product was going to be spoiled, left sitting on the countertop. And at some point, we really thought it had, as it had a viciously strong, yeasty smell that almost bordered on a mold from the sniff of the jar. But brave enough to sample what was in there. And in fact, it was more alcoholic in nature than the gentle mead that we put in the refrigerator about 2+ weeks ago. So this jar has been sitting on the countertop for 2+ weeks, fermenting in the jar, in the container, and we thought it had spoiled, but actually it was doing what it was supposed to do and getting its mojo on. I have to tell you, 2 days ago we were concerned that it was ruined and really considered pouring it down the sink, but as I said, the brave taste test discovered that it was okay, and it was just that odor that was confusing, odor and our inexperience that was confusing the situation. In fact, I was happy with the strength of the mead from the alcohol side, and I put what was left, about half the batch, into a wine bottle and put that in the refrigerator, and I'm contemplating pulling what was in the refrigerator and letting it cook a little more. So there happens to be a bee social BEE terminology, there is a bee social get-together coming up at the Old York Cellars Winery. Fellow Northwestern beekeeper Roger Gares has graciously arranged the gathering and has been a mead dabbler himself. And he invited others to bring some mead to sample along with a covered dish. For the first time ever, I'm excited to say that I'll be able to contribute and bring some of this mead for people to try and ask people what they think of it. And the funny thing is, Sharon and I are not much for drinking alcohol, so I'm actually happy to have a forum to disseminate it before it goes bad, because we won't drink it. Even though it tastes good, I have to say, I tried it again a little bit tonight, and it's still very palatable and enjoyable. So on that note, before I leave this topic, let me add one more mead notion to the pile. I've had on my to-do list a task to visit the Melovino Meadery and connect back up with mead maker Sergio Mutella. We came to know Sergio around this time last year when he presented his ideas at the winter NJBA meeting that he was starting up a New Jersey meadery, the first one in the state. I probably covered that on this episode somewhere about last year, if you're interested in that. So he was working on his permit and other things at the time. And this past weekend, Sharon and I made the trip out to see the operation because we had some errands to run somewhere up in North Jersey and work this in. And we got to do a short interview with Sergio about how things have been going. I've got to organize my notes from our visit because I have a bunch to say about this. And it was just a few days ago and I didn't get a chance to process it. But I plan to talk about this in our, you know, in a future feature segment in our next episode. All I could say is we had a great time, and I can't wait to bring you the information about what he's got going on, because we're really excited about what he's been doing there. I'm really happy for him. I know I'm eternally optimistic, but he's doing a really, really good job there, and I'm excited to bring what he has going on. So anyway, if you're in the area and want to be social, the get-together is Tuesday night, 6 p.m. this upcoming week. The week of like March 8th, 9th, something like that, 2015. Just let Roger know if you plan to attend if you're in the area so he can confirm the accommodations. And I believe the address for Melovino, if you want to get a head start, is melovino.com. I'll confirm that before the episode is out. If I got it wrong, I'll come back and fix it. If not, now you know. Actually, let me just pause the tape. It's melovino.com, Melovino. It's right next to Millburn, New Jersey, if you're not going to wait until the next episode to come out. Okay, roundtable number 3, June tea. It's not your mother's mead. Since it is a related beverage that involves honey, I'll segue right into this topic. John Gott shared a shared a recipe with me for June tea. I recently listened to the Alton Brown podcast called the Alton Browncast. I think that's what it's referred to. He had an interview with Chef Jonathan Sawyer. In that episode, they discussed an aged eggnog, making vinegar, and several other topics around the notion of fermentation. I guess it's apropos to know that June tea is a fermented mixture of tea and honey and used like a probiotic drink. I've never had this product before, but given my recent experience with mead, I'm intrigued. John described it in his email as tasting like cider that is starting to go hard. Kind of sweet, kind of tart. The email that he sent me has a reference to a recipe from a friend of a friend, Dr. Noah DeCoyer of Bayonne, that goes over the process and tips for making this product. Actually, I'm going to hold off on presenting it for now because I'm going to pursue a chance to see if we can get him on the podcast to talk about it firsthand. So stay posted, guys and girls. We'll see what we can do for that. So circling back on the Alton Browncast, I highly recommend it. I have to say, I've always been a fan, and he could talk about chick beef on toast and make it interesting. That's my belief. His podcast is most definitely not on food alone, which is what you would think from the guy who did Good Eats. And I think you'll find that he's an interesting guy, into a ton of interesting things, and it is highly recommended. It could be noted that he recently switched podcast providers. So we had a good number of episodes with Nerdist, which I think is a podcast provider, and he really recently switched to another one. So if you see the last episode was his interview with William Shatner, that's the old version, and the new one has about 6 to 8, maybe more, and I'm starting to get caught up. I had lost track of him for a while. When you look in iTunes, you might see both of them. It's worth going back and listening to him. John Hodgman was a great interview. The guy who, I'm a Mac, you're a PC, that thing. He's that comedian, and there's just a ton of good content there. Go check it out. Roundtable number 4, Aware We Will Go. Somehow I made it to March and neglected to talk about the Aware hive Santa brought me for Christmas. Mrs. Claus England knew that this was something on my wish list and that I had commented that engineering-wise, it was not something that I thought I had the bandwidth to tackle. I'm reasonable enough with woodworking and could build this thing with the proper energy, but the number of hours required in a row to build one of these exceeded my ability to set aside enough time to accomplish the effort with the 8,000 other things I have going on. So I said at some point that if enough time had passed and I didn't get into finish this, I would circle back with Chris Cole from Sweet Valley Hives and support his effort with a purchase. And that's exactly what I did. I'm very excited to have one of these for the apiary this year, and if the weather ever breaks, I will get out to the garage and assemble it. It's snowing and sleeting outside for the 10th time this year. I'm being facetious, but that's probably true. And as I produce this, I might have to resort to moving my hive preparations to my basement. It's been 0 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit and no warmer since the beginning of February. I think we had one 40-degree day 2 Sundays ago, but I was out of the area all day. I guess spring will eventually get here, and we can get to beekeeping and racing, which is my other passion. Incidentally, Corey England, my nephew, and Kyle will be racing again. Corey picked up sponsorship from a restaurant chain called Quaker Steak and Lube. We lettered the car this past weekend, or the weekend before that, I don't remember. It's been a blur. And the car was in a mall show, and it looks really cool, and excited to get to the racing season. Just a general little aside. So I have a message from this topic, meaning Aware Hives, from Jake Wagner. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for your insightful email. I want you to look for a message from me with interest to record a segment, if you're willing, on the stuff you gave me, because I think there's a topic there altogether. If I get a chance, I'll reach out this weekend. I got a bunch of plans, but I will be in contact, Jake, to see if you have an interest in coming on the show and talking about a couple things. Jake wrote me back with some information and insight about Aware Hives and about the foundationless segment from episode number 3, and I'm really interested in giving him some coverage there on some of his thoughts. So hopefully he'll take me up on that in a future episode. 2 more roundtables to go. I'm going to go into a little editorial here for roundtable number 5. I call this one Imprint. Lately, I find myself doing something that's not typical of me, and I'm here to publicly declare my intention to put this practice to rest. In listening back on some of my most recent episodes, I find myself obsessed with my point of view and have heard myself making several whiny attempts at defending my thoughts around treatment for bees. You see, I've had this little voice in my head like a bad little devil sitting on my shoulder, whispering to me that treatments are evil and I'm just another shill for the establishment. I think it is perfectly normal to consider all sides and to be conscientious about not professing a right versus wrong approach. But lately, I've been fretting about the notion that even expressing the belief to treat would be ridiculed in public as such a misguided and outmoded notion. That little devil whispering in my ear. I have come to decide that no treatments for me. It's an irrational idea, and I'm constantly confronted with the hard data in New Jersey that demands the treatments are necessary, and quite frankly, I'm just growing fatigued in the holy war that's going on out there and the fear of public ridicule for expressing an opinion on this. I've decided that this crap is baggage, and I'm going to do what I feel is right for what is in front of me. If mite loads are excessive, I will treat, or I'm going to take some sort of action as appropriate. I will fret no more, for in my mind, there is no more wasted energy in this world than with someone who frets all the time. There's nothing more that sucks the life out of any situation. I have to be true to myself, so the imprint I leave from this body of work, the podcast and my beekeeping, reflects my principles and beliefs, misguided, flawed, or perfect as history will decide. I'm going to continue to tell it like it is. I will present alternative ideas to ensure people know that there are options out there, but I'm done with the strife of trying to explain my actions to the people who would deride a decision that is mine to make without walking a mile in my shoes. Yep, I feel better now. And thanks for listening. Roundtable number 6, the final one. Couple of listener shout-outs. Scott Sizemore from Charlotte, North Carolina, wrote in about using a plunge router to cut handholds. Sounds like a good idea, Scott. I have a router, but I never had much luck with it. But I could envision that being a good way to go. Especially if you had some sort of template, but maybe you know a secret to that. Scott, are you a NASCAR fan? I think that's ingrained in everybody out there in Charlotte, North Carolina. Cindy Aaron from the Land of Mermaids wrote in. She's a first-year beekeeper working with Caucasian bees and has her hive protected with Reflectex. It's a reflective insulating material. And apropos, because we just did an insulating segment not too far back. You know, given that my in-laws live just north of you in Homosassa, I know you guys have been having some unusually cold weather these past few weeks. Of course, my mother-in-law, not in a malicious way, but just in general, called this morning to tell my wife that it was going to be 75 today. So I digress because I think it was 8 degrees when she called. So also in the email was a photo of an interesting ventilated plexiglass cover that you're using. I'm not sure if that's something you invented or something you picked up along the way. I'm fascinated to know how that works. And as I said earlier, I'm coming down there in a short while and plan to visit our friends the Wazatowskis, who overwinter there in Weeki Wachee. So maybe if it's not too creepy, we could somehow work in a way to stop in and say hello. I think before I finish this little tidbit about Cindy's comments, I should explain the Land of Mermaids. Weeki Wachee has this park where they have people who do a mermaid show. They wear air tanks and they swim around in mermaid fins. If you're ever in that part, just north of Tampa, relatively, you need to stop in and see that. It's a part of Americana. Last but not least, Nick Farrell from Great Britain. Glad to hear we're an inspiration. We are honored and thank you for writing in. I'll pass along to Bob Kloss that you said howdy, but I already know he's listening to this episode and it's probably mission accomplished for you. So with that, we've come to the end of what we had to offer for this episode. So I want to take a moment to take some time to thank those who write in and to those who generously donate to our podcast via our PayPal link on our homepage. I have to say I'm truly honored that the regular listeners would take time out of their busy schedules to interact with us and support the podcast by writing in, sharing links, just being beekeepers, communicating and networking. And especially if you're making a donation. I don't drive for those things, but when they come in, I heartfeltly appreciate that. So I'll do my best to continue to make the effort worthwhile. And to Andrew, Bonnie, and any others that I might have missed, thank you. I wanted to end with this. Ryan Olson, appreciate your email that came through. Everybody check out Ryan's blog, www.angrygardener.com. There's some good stuff there to see. And Ryan, your Pizziello recipe, your pizza thing, the pictures made my mouth water. That looks so good. I don't know who took that picture, but they should have been a Food Network star photographer. Looks like some good work there. Keep it up. All right. That's the end of this episode. I will end with this final thought. Until next time, remember, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well.